All right, here we are. Welcome back to Bookwave. This is your wake-up call. September is over. So today we're going to do a wave cast today all about our plans for October and the rest of the winter. So, I'm Scott, joined today by Pat.
Yo.
Will.
Hola.
And if you're new around here, you should check us out at our website, www.bookwave.club. And why don't you start us off, Will? What are your plans for the next month?
So, as you may or may not know, I just got retained at a local business doing IT. So, I've got some money coming in and I'm able to pay my bills. All of my monthly expenses are covered by this contract. And it's very flexible with hours, which is going to allow me to continue to work on my yoga teacher training 200-hour course. Because of COVID, the Yoga Alliance has allowed online schools to actually certify at the international level with the Yoga Alliance seal students. And they just made an announcement today that they're going to be extending that beyond the end of the year into 2021. So a lot of the pressure in that regard is off. And I'm on Wednesday, I'll be in my third week of a 26-week business coaching program, taking my monthly revenue to $10,000 a month. And today I was thinking of Pat when I was doing some yoga work, because I do this thing with my self-practice log. I need to do 50 hours of self-practice. And one of the things I've been doing is journaling as well. And so after my first 2 weeks, I had journaled. And then today I journaled again. And I noticed it had been 40 days since the last time I journaled. And so that was interesting, because it was like, oh, 40 days. Jesus did that in the desert. Here I am. And in that time, I've gotten my driver's license and this contract, started this business coaching program. And I'm really getting beyond sort of stuck in rumination in the present moment. And that's something that I've been working on this past year. I think over the past few years, I really did a good job of cleaning up my triggers and my anxieties and my depression, and sort of being able to be present and not reactive. But what's been missing, and what I've been able to see that is missing, is a future that is structured and sort of based in goals with small actionable steps, so that instead of just being in the present and being one with myself and in tune with my emotions, I also have goals and a plan, so that all of my actions that I make standing in the present awareness get me closer to my goals. And that's something that I couldn't create for myself in the state that I'd been in for the past several years. And it's something that's crucial, and it's something I'm working on for the next month and beyond, to really, at a hypnotic, subconscious, meditative level, install the plan, so that when I'm in a situation, I know where I'm going. And it's not just about resolving the current context, but actually making the most of it to get me where I'm going. And one of the things I wrote down, I think the first time I journaled, August 18th, was this sentence. I'll just read it because I really like it. I need to develop and adhere to a template of established goals, rituals, and practices that drive data about my progress to give me a location in relation to the greater landscape, a landscape that I need to study and expand my awareness of. And so that's just my own personal philosophy. And that's why I enjoy this podcast so much, you know, reading philosophy, reading about authors, getting perspective. Whereas, you know, many people are quite capable of not looking into the deeper sort of parts of their brain and just doing their 40 hours a week and making their money. For me, it's always been, yeah, but what about the life I'm living? And what about fulfillment every day? And so that's what I'm up to, making goals, making a plan, sticking to it, getting consistent.
Yeah, that sounds good. You are, when you say you're learning different, when you're going and reading philosophies of, I'm guessing, various people like Marcus Aurelius and all these other, are you looking for specific meditations from them?
I think it's more just knowing how many options there are. I think the problem that a lot of people have is they don't even know that there's a philosophy that completely contradicts the way they live, and that there's a philosophy that completely complements the way they live. And for me, you know, for 5 or 6 years now, I've been thinking I got into yoga the physical side of yoga to save my life. And it's only since I started the teacher training that it was really the philosophy of yoga that saved my life. And it was the study of Raja yoga and the perennial philosophy and, you know, meditating on the Bhagavad Gita that I really identified with beyond even realizing that it was the philosophy of yoga that I was kind of absorbing and amalgamating with my own existence. And so it's interesting for me to realize that that's the lifestyle I'm living. And now when I study it, it changes my perspective. But there's so many options, and people have been thinking for so long about what it takes to get all of the living entities on the planet to do well. And I think that we're missing something if we don't inform ourselves of the options. And I think that we need to be able to get to a place as a society where we're all literate in the modes of philosophy in order to collectively create something that resolves these problems.
Wow, that's a big mouthful. But yeah, I totally get it. I would just, you know, write down something that I need to do during the day, and then I just do it.
Right. See, that's great, you know, if you're able to do that. And for me, it's like, I know that I can learn to do anything. And so it becomes right action. And the question of what is the right action and what will get me the closest and fastest towards my goals. And it's that notion of like 20% of our productivity creates 80% of our results. And if you look at that again, like 4% of our productivity creates 64% of our results when you 80-20 the 80-20 of your productivity. So it's like, what is the good thing to do? And there's this sentence I came up with today when I was journaling, which is like, I feel, I think, I believe this is what I need to do. I'm not convinced that I know and operate from this belief, but I feel, I think, I believe this. And it's getting beyond the feeling, I think I believe this, to actually just activating that belief and doing stuff and sort of having initiative and momentum come up from my subconscious mind based on my reality, instead of just, oh, well, I've read this thing and they say that if I do this for 3 weeks, I'll be a better person. It's like, but I've read 1,000 things that say that. So which one's right? And, you know, when you have a photographic memory as well, and you can retain the majority of what you read, it's like I personally get stuck in this mire of, but there's so many apparent ways to live rightly. How do I know which thing is going to create the most success? And that's the way that I hijack my own existence.
Yeah. And plus, since there are 1,000 different books on how to do one thing or multiple things, the best thing you can do for yourself is ask if this is right for me. And also just, it's all a matter of trying to remain aware of your actions during the day and your thoughts that come to you. And plus, another thing too is, and I've learned this from Dr. K from Healthy Gamer GG, is that when we're having trouble trying to start something, if there's something that we need to do during the day or a new habit that we want to develop, one thing that happens, especially the moment that we wake up, is we have these unconscious thoughts by default streaming up. And if you check the internet, if you check your email, social media and all that, you are completely done. You won't be able to obtain the tasks that you need to do during the day. But when you repeat yourself, well, when you think about what you want to do in your life, what brings fulfillment, and then you just kind of retain it over time, soon it'll be set to your default setting, and all the unconscious thoughts start to wither away. There's no more factories bubbling up unconscious thoughts. And you can use those factories in your mind to produce conscious thoughts and multiply them over time. So for me, I've been trying to get into the habit of waking up at 4 in the morning every day, because around midweek, every midweek, I have to get up and drive down to the city for work. And I was trying to apply that for the rest of the week instead of just having to wake up at 6 a.m. for me. And just to go along with kind of like what you're doing, Will, is for me is to be able to write every day and letting the power of storytelling lead me.
Right. That 4 a.m. start sounds insane, though. Oh, my God.
You have fun with that one. That one's not for me. I like to sleep.
But that's the hard thing, like, because I like to sleep in, but I hate to wake up late. And, like, waking up at even 7 in the morning, especially if I'm going in to do some IT work, like, by 8 a.m. when we're heading to work, the wife and I, it's like, I haven't had time to do anything that I wanted to do. With 1 hour, I can wake up in the morning. That's about it. Like, I can do maybe the shower and the breakfast and the walk and the mindfulness and feel on. But it's like, once I'm on, it's like, now I wish I had been up for 2 hours so that I can spend an hour maybe doing some self-practice with my yoga or some homework from my business coaching or from my yoga course or literally anything.
And that also bleeds into, like, oh, you hate yourself when you let yourself stay up past midnight kind of thing, because you got to wake up at an appropriate hour. And, like, just going back to the different philosophies and stuff, it's like what you said with all the different contradicting philosophies. How do you decide between objectivism and Buddhism and Christianity? Like, you have all these options that seem like they work, but... you know, it's really hard to figure out which one works for you until you start with trial and error and really seeing how they all work.
Yeah. And for me, I think the way I respect philosophy is a lot like the way I respect books, in that the longer the book has survived, the more I respect and appreciate and am interested in it. Because, and it's weird too, because of course the popular books don't stand the test of time, and it's the surprising ones that survive for hundreds of years. But especially with philosophy, the older you get and the, like, longer it stays relevant, the more interested I am in that. So, like, Christianity and Muslim or Islam and pretty much anything created after zero is, like, off the bandwagon. Like, it's like, I'm sorry, but if you're adapting a former philosophy, I'm just gonna look at the root,
right?
And I don't know if that's accurate, and maybe it's completely inaccurate. Maybe we need to be creating a philosophy today for today's age, but I don't think that makes as much sense as something that has survived throughout the past 5, 10, 20,000 years.
No, I think you're right there, because that triggered something in my head, because I've been learning how to, like, try to draw recently, and some of the advice that comes up over and over again is, you know, try to draw from reality, like photographs and, like, actual faces, draw objects that are actually there and try to imitate what's actually in real life. Because if you just try to imitate somebody else's art style, you end up internalizing all of their mistakes and incorporating everything that they've done wrong that you don't really want in your style. So you got to start with, like, the fundamentals just from reality, so you can actually make something look real before you can, you know, cartoonify it or comic stylify it.
Well, and, like, I'd argue the same thing is with, like, math, right? Like, you can memorize formulae, but until you know that a formula is a thing that solves a problem, and when you have a problem, all you have to do is identify what the formula is you need for the problem and then plug in the variables, you'll get your answer every time. It's like, it's one thing to play a guitar and play a song that you've memorized how to play or hit chords on a keyboard. It's another thing to make music and to understand notes and sounds and math and art. Like, there is a base root that all things have grown from. And it's like, if you just pop on to the newest branch, you're going to snap it with the weight of all the other people that are on that branch. And there's going to be nothing new created there.
Mm-hmm. And that's especially dangerous for any kind of philosophy that exists solely for the purpose of debunking another philosophy. Like, I don't think we would have Satanism without Christianity. Am I wrong?
Right. Well, and I take the non-contradiction of Aristotle into even yoga philosophy, right? Like, A equals A. A does not equal B. B equals B. Right. And it's like, you read the Sutras of Patanjali, and I apologize to anyone who speaks Sanskrit. I definitely don't know how to pronounce Patanjali. Anyways, you read the sutras, which are the threads on yoga, and essentially it's like three or four words that were jotted down on bamboo by his students while he was speaking about the logos of yoga, what it means to do yoga and be yoga. And then you have transliterations, you know, you have gurus in the past 300 years who have published books on their opinion of the transliterations of yoga. And I lost my thought. Oh, yeah. Okay, contradiction, non-contradiction. So you get into the yoga, and you've got this guy who's writing his opinion on what yoga means, much like any religion or religious figure sort of trying to understand the sacred text. And in one sentence, they say, all matter is created of the divine energy. All matter and all form is divine energy. And then in the next sentence, they say, don't eat animals. If everything is created of the same divine energy, why wouldn't you sooner tell me not to eat metal than you would an animal? Because if we're all equal, how is there any difference if I eat a cow?
Some animals are more equal than others.
And it's like, so then, and then they use the argument from a different branch of Hinduism and say, oh, well, because of reincarnation, if you eat a pig, it might be your grandmother. And it's like, but also you've told me that it's just a ship or a vessel for the soul, and that I am not my body. You're telling me that I am something higher and connected to a greater consciousness, and that I can shed this mortal bond and transcend humanity and become one with the divine energy. So how can it be that and also bad to eat a pig or a cow? And how could it be better to eat broccoli? How is broccoli less than pig if they're both divine substance? Like, that's a contradiction.
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, in the Bible, it goes into the details about some animals are unclean, but the rest of them, go eat those. It says in the Bible. Yeah. If you're a vegan and you're a devout Christian, there's a contradiction there. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying there's a contradiction there. Because it says, Yahweh tells you in the Old Testament, these animals thou shalt eat. And then he lists them all off, so... You can't live your life without contradictions if you try to pick them all apart, but...
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I'm not saying you should eat pigs or you shouldn't eat pigs, but I am certainly saying you shouldn't have contradictions. Yeah. And if there is a contradiction, maybe you've overreached with your philosophy.
Yeah, that's a lesson that I learned from back in my early days of watching George Carlin comedy specials, because he'd always talk about, you know, the hypocrisy of, you know, pride in American culture or Western culture. You always hear, like, I'm proud to be an American, or Irish pride, but when, as soon as you start talking about the cardinal sins, pride is first on the list. You know, it's one of the seven deadly sins, but in our culture today, it's frowned upon if you're not proud of where you're from. But what have you really accomplished if you're just born and, you know, a nice little patch of dirt with a good economy?
Well, and that's the thing, too. Go ahead, Pat.
I think we should just respond to these contradictions with derisive laughter, because we know we are not perfect and we're all different. So that's one way we can do that.
The problem is when people who live the contradictory philosophies and don the tinfoil hat in conversations with family and friends and start to convert them into ignorance and contradictory philosophy and say that their way is the right way when they haven't studied the other ways.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a certain duty and responsibility when it comes to, getting all of your hypocrisies set in order. At least acknowledge them when someone points them out. And if you can live with them, if it's something minor, like, well, I can say I'm a vegan for these reasons, and I can say I'm a Buddhist for these reasons, and I can live with that contradiction and it won't bother me much. But there's other things that don't quite make sense when you try to mesh two ideologies together. Like
Well, and it's like even.
objectivism, like if you're trying to be an objectivist coming from like third wave feminism, you're gonna run into
Third or
some
fourth?
I don't
Third or
know.
fourth wave? It's fourth wave now, just so you know.
It's fourth now? Okay, jeez.
Yeah, me too
Sorry.
equals fourth wave.
Okay. Sorry.
I did a deep binge on Wikipedia a few days ago. And that's the thing, because like there are systems to explain things, but when, like, for example, with yoga and veganism and saying, okay, it's divine matter and you shouldn't eat animals because they have a soul, it's like, whoa, like let's just look at it like, physiologically or biologically and say, like, oh, our digestive tract isn't the same as primarily meat eaters. And in fact, when you look at, what is it, carnivores? Is that the word for it? They have a very short intestinal tract to get the meat out of their system fast, whereas we don't. And it's like we've got these teeth that are sort of hybrids, and maybe we should have a little bit of meat and a lot of vegetables. And it's like if you explain that to me through this lens of health and anatomy, it's like, okay, yeah, like I'm with you. We probably, and even just in terms of environment and economy, it's like we probably shouldn't be having a pound of meat with every meal. Because that's 21 billion pounds of meat a day if everyone got that amount of meat. That just doesn't sound sustainable to me. But then it's like, if you can make it sustainable, the argument falls out.
Yeah, just always pay attention to quantity and quality.
Yeah, and it's like, don't be afraid to actually think about something so deep that you completely understand what you're talking about and have an informed decision. Because I'm not there, but I'm certainly tunneling.
Yeah. For me, when it comes to like diet and the things that we're eating, I always like I think that you should focus on your own health before any of the other factors. Because that way you can, get rid of all the junk that you really don't need, like French fries and, McDonald's and potato chips and chocolate and all this. And then once you get like your morals involved, you can decide if you want to like give up meat, 'cause then your body might actually be prepared for it. 'Cause if you're just eating a terrible diet and you decide, "Oh my God, the factory farming system is destroying everything that like it's destroying our children's future," let's say. And you make the decision that you have to stop eating meat, but you keep eating garbage. You're not going to find yourself in a good headspace. It's not going to work out for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And it like so I was talking with my buddy about linear curriculums last week, which is where, in math you learn that numbers are a thing. And then you learn that you can count things. And then you learn that you can add things, and then you learn you can subtract things and multiply and divide, and then you get into quadratics, and then you get into algebra, and then you get into calculus. And it's like, just at its core, like knowing numbers exist is practical and beneficial because, like, holy cow, counting is very handy. But when you look at maybe history or politics
It's a fairly new way of
or
thinking about it, realistically, when like just in numbers, because when you look back at Euclid and his geometry started with one single point, then it was two points, then it was a line connecting the two, and then it starts off with geometry like that, and then you learn how to count. So that's really kind of an advanced introduction if you're just learning how to count
Yeah,
first.
but it's crazy and radically practical immediately. But when you look at history and you're told, okay, you are an American child and you need to memorize these 75 dates of wars, these 150 warring parties, these 4,000 battlefields, and these 15,000 statistics on the impact on the economy, it's like, how does that practically apply to my existence? And then you go over and you do English and you read Catcher in the Rye and you're like, okay, but I hate reading and I hate being forced to read. How does that apply to my existence? And then you go to philosophy and religion and you learn that Christians do things a certain way, but you're like, still, how does that affect my life? And it's like, when you have, what is the term? A curriculum, a spiral curriculum, where you say, let's create the subject of how to live an informed and good life. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at how philosophies impacted war, how war impacted economy, how economy impacted the mind, how the mind reacted to the times and created a new philosophy that created a new war. And we're going to look at all of it all of the time and practically tell you why this actually means, if you understand this stuff, you can make choices based on past experiences of entire countries and civilizations in your everyday to day life that stops you from being a bully or a bystander or invalid who hides in his basement and plays video games for 24 hours a day. Because I've been there and I didn't have this spiral curriculum that told me that all war and all economy and all religion and spiritual quests for all of and art, all of this stuff, it all had to do with everything that life is about. But instead it was a linear curriculum and I had to memorize dates. And it's like, that isn't practical and I can't take that anywhere. Lots.
Yeah. And you also gave me a story idea.
Yay.
Thank you. Thank you, Will.
You are welcome. Now share.
No, I'm keeping it to myself.
All right. Have a good day, guys.
A spiral curriculum. That'd be interesting. And also, it can determine what kind of occupation you would like to take up. And for me, I was never really good at science history or whatnot, math. I was always in my head all the time coming up with different things. And it turned out that I wanted to go into entrepreneurship and creative writing and everything like that. And that was all based on the results I've gotten over my time in school most of the time. So it's all about paying attention to your instincts and interests.
Yeah, and it's like, go ahead.
If we could just underline that and just be aware of it, then we would create a whole lot of things.
Did you guys ever play Red Rover in the playground?
Yeah, a little.
I don't recall Red Rover.
Red Rover, come on over.
Yeah, this was a banned childhood playground game at the time that I was in elementary school, where you formed two lines in the playground and you would yell, Red Rover, we call Johnny over. And Johnny would have to run from his line and try and get through your line. And the point was that you could create this impenetrable wall of bodies that Johnny wasn't able to get through. Yeah. And if Johnny did get through, he won. And it was banned because it was violent. And it was like, holy cow, turn that into a learning experience. Like, turn dodgeball into a learning experience. Teach us about a phalanx. Teach us about, like, all sorts of things. Instead of saying, that's bad, you can't do it. And it's like, you're holding the keys to understanding by not explaining the philosophy and the impact and the meaning behind having teams and fighting.
Yeah, I feel like just what you said about the connections between certain subjects. Like, I was always kind of into history and welding class, but you know what would have been incredible? The history of welding. Like that.
And the impact on civilization as we discovered arc welding and all of these different things.
Yes, and like the collapse of the Bronze Age being ushered in by like being able to smelt iron at a higher temperature and like how weaponry has impacted just technology for better life, that kind of stuff.
And how it's impacted the longevity of the structures we've built, which has created a space where we can now, instead of routinely investing in wood that keeps rotting out, we can actually use cement and rebar and build things that last 1,000 years and save 1,000 years of building budgets now and invest that into healthcare. And it's like, man, there's so much missed.
When we talk about like how valuable seeing the synchronicities in life are. Like when Carl Jung talks about like synchronicities just in dreams abstracted from real life. And then you start seeing the synchronicities like from day-to-day life. Imagine how much we could give to students if we just started like, you know, every other week, some of the your history teacher and your geography teacher team up to teach a class together, and they, you know, teach you about how history has aspected this event and how geography has aspected the same kind of flow on something. Or like we were talking about before, the history of geometry with Euclid's Elements. Like I never heard about Euclid's Elements until I started researching the Bible. And I heard, like, well, the Bible's the most commonly published book in the world, but number two is actually Euclid's Elements. So that's pretty cool.
That's news to me.
Yeah, and, like, number three is, like, Mao's Red Book, something like that. I'm a little fucked.
Right.
There's also, like, a couple of different statistics, too, for, like, best sold books and, like, most republished, that kind of stuff. So don't quote me on that.
So what's interesting is... In colleges, and I don't know if you know what the distinction is, Pat, so I'll define it here just in case anyone doesn't know. But in Canada, we have colleges and universities. And universities are more expensive and more theoretical, and colleges are practical trades. Like,
yeah.
Always. Yeah, so yeah. Plumbing, electrical, registered massage therapists, things like that. And what I've discovered in talking with my buddy last week is that actually the colleges do have what appears to resemble a spiral syllabus, at least in the registered massage therapy course that he's in, and they're trialing it right now, because what was happening is students were getting to clinic and they were failing. Like 70% of the students were failing, and the teachers were like, oh, we are doing something completely wrong. Let's try something different. And so I did a video game development course from Udemy, nothing crazy, not even really a nano degree, right? Like it's just a $20 course, but they had a spiral syllabus, and it's the standard popularized learn to make games by making games. And the first game you make, they get rid of all of the jargon and just get you coding right away, making every single feature that is required in a video game. You don't know what you're doing or how it works, but you know that you are getting exposed to it and doing it. And the further along you go, the more the concepts that you were exposed to but didn't understand crop up and get built on. And it's the same in the trades, whereas in university, you get your textbook and you go through unit one and you go through unit two and then you go through unit three. And it's like, you can get stuck in this world of theory and non-practicality. And it's like, if we can create an environment where someone can stay in school for 30 years, how does that benefit humanity? Because that just seems like a bigger cave to me. You know what I mean? Like you can isolate yourself from humanity. You can consume all the knowledge you want in the world. But once you've learned stuff, if you don't bring it back and show others the fastest way to do it, because I'll tell you right now, obfuscation and confusion of philosophy does not help anyone. What we need to do is create the embedded societal understanding of concepts like plumbing and electrical work. These should not be so far from reality that we have to cover electrical sockets for children because we just don't want them to understand how it works and why it's a bad thing.
And there's
trade schools. I mean, that's the thing. They do not say trade schools. They just only refer to you to college or university for that. But yeah, I totally get it. And it's and it just goes. Another thing that they do is you, once you enter college or university, you have to take required courses, some of which are not relevant or related to your field of interest.
And 150 years ago, those required courses would have taught you everything you needed to know to be a functional man, a Renaissance man, a member of society with a storied experience that is history and art and gymnastics and philosophy and creative writing. And instead now what happens is you can go to school to be a computer scientist and you must take a couple electives and you will learn math and computer science in this context and this context alone. And there's no general arts requirement. You don't need to know how politics works and why we've gotten to here with the politics we've employed and why philosophy is necessary and what it means to be a human. You don't get that anymore. We have fast track pipelines to get people from end of high school into their cubicle. And that's 100% of the reason I dropped out.
Same.
I wish I didn't. I regret dropping out, but I don't regret the experience I missed. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I wish I hadn't had to drop out because I couldn't get that learning.
I would say that just like with healthcare, college and universities are incomplete. They're not broken, but they're incomplete. And yeah. It just requires just a little bit more context and a lot more thinking before it's all constructed, I would say.
I think I have a kind of a good example. Like when we come up with a new piece of technology, there's always going to be some kind of a risk that comes with it. Like when we invented automobiles, like how many car accidents would there be if we didn't have like the invention of automobiles? But like a little bit after that, we were able to lower that number of, you know, accidents and deaths because of those accidents with things like seatbelts and airbags and things like that. So we're constantly in this correction mode for things like that. Like that's, I think that's why it feels like it's incomplete, because there's always more that we can be doing. So like when Elon Musk says that, you know, the solution is self-driving cars for everybody. That way they'll all be automated in the same mainframe and none of them will crash. No automobile accidents. So there's always more that we can do, even though like we created this, you know, garbage pile of an education system and it doesn't really work as good as it could. There's always things we can do to improve it and perfect it.
Yeah, but then it gets to this place where you have this system that resists change. And you have so many moving parts. And it's like, I think that what the education system did best was teach me what it did the worst. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's like, if I hadn't gone through it, I wouldn't know what was wrong with it. And that's what it taught me. And that's incredible to be able to criticize a structure so large and wide and like, grass-rooted into our very makeup of modern civilization. To be able to have an opinion that is negative of that is simply a compliment to it in itself.
Yeah, I don't think the resistance to change is necessarily a bad thing, because that forces our like improvements, our suggested improvements, to be actually something that could work. And like it has to be a good idea or they're just going to shut it down, because they have every reason to want to keep it the same way. Same way with having liberals and conservatives, you know, we got to keep what's good, improve what we can. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, though.
It was like, I saw this post on Instagram the other day about the average ages of leaders in parliament and members of parliament and Congress. And it was like, I think it was aimed at the states for averages, but like when it got down to the representative members of parliament, it was like the average age was 57. And I looked at that number and I thought, that's just about perfect.
So a bunch of 70-year-olds or 35-year-olds.
Exactly. So it's like at 57, you've got, you know that not everyone's 57. Some are younger, some are older.
Yeah.
But they've lived their life and they've had experience. Whereas the comments are demanding 25-year-olds to be in parliament. It's like, I don't want to be in parliament. Are you fucking kidding me? Don't put that responsibility on me. I haven't lived for enough decades and experienced enough corners of this earth and studied enough things to be able to make an informed decision. And they, of course, plead the, oh, but with ignorance comes creativity and you see what they don't see. And it's like, yeah, but like,
those who don't know our history are doomed to repeat it, especially when put in positions of power.
Like, oh, and it's like, have you, like, read the Republic. Like, just one good look at the Republic and realize maybe it's unavoidable that you have to understand and learn and grow for a while before you can make decisions.
Yeah.
Like, if the average age of a member of parliament was 40, I would be horrified. If 20-year-olds were making decisions on behalf of 360 million people or 30 million people or 3 million people, I would be horrified. Like, you can run a group of 2 to 4 in your class.
Yeah, but it's also, it also kind of worries me if the average is at 57. there probably aren't too many 57-year-olds. It's probably going to be a perfect mix of, you know, old people that don't know where they are anymore and young people who have yet to ever realize where they are.
And I hear that, and I think maybe we need some safety nets to make sure that we don't have demented old people in Parliament. But I think it's necessary to have the people that have the old ways and the value and the cemented beliefs of their structures fighting the people that are old enough to know that it's time to change and smart enough and experienced enough to debate it eloquently to get them to see the error of their ways or the opportunity of their ways. Whereas if we had, like, you know, this demented and then also young people fighting, it would just turn into this disgusting protest riot thing that just doesn't pan out.
Yeah, I would say just leave the young outside of politics at least until they turn 35.
Yeah, but like higher politics. Because if you're 35 or under, volunteer. Go to town council, go to meetings, join a committee, and start learning what politics is and be in a safety net that allows you to make mistakes and not know what you're talking about. But don't ignore it because you're young and ignorant. Like, get involved.
If you're going to make politics your goal, you can't just say, all right, I'm 18, fresh out of high school, time to be a politician. No, there's steps to go up to being a politician. You don't have to just right away, I'm going to run for office. I'm going to be the next mayor of my, you know, old conservative town that doesn't know any better.
and get that one record for being the youngest politician out there in the world.
We've got a young council member in one of the towns near me, and he's a young kid, and it's hard to respect him. And he's got new ideas, and his new ideas mostly just kind of look like throwing events and not actually making the town a better place. And so it's like, okay, yeah, enthusiasm of a young person and the idea that events and amenities, that's good. Sure. Totally. But like, I don't know if that's enough.
Yeah. A lot of people said the same thing about Trudeau, but now we're stuck with him.
So this young politician that you brought up, Will, what has he done or she done?
Well, exactly. Like, he works, I believe he's an electrician, so he's got a trade, and he's done a lot of community outreach, I guess you could say, but it's not even outreach, it's community engagement is the real word for it. So he's very good at making posts on Facebook and Instagram and not sharing the actual details of council meetings and trying to fight for events like watching Jaws in the park on floaties on the lake and stuff like that. Whereas real stuff, whenever I have questions about like, oh, what's happening with the homeless population? It's not him. It's someone else. And like, I respect his enthusiasm, and I hope that he'll grow and realize that there's a lot more that it takes. But it's like, just because he's an electrician, that's not the problem. Just because he's young, that's not the problem. The problem is he went from being in the background to running for council. And it's like, how many committees have you headed up? And how many times are you volunteering? And what volunteer organization have you brought to the forefront? And how much of life have you really experienced? You know what I mean? Like, those are the questions.
Sounds
that
to me
I
like
ask.
He's just having a fun time, you know, in a position of power.
Yeah, and then what happens
is Nietzsche's philosophy.
If you have one guy like that and then a couple other people who really shouldn't be politicians and aren't politicians and for some reason got popularity votes, it's like now we've got a half full, half cocked council because we don't have real politicians. And it's like, okay, yeah, it's a small town, population of 17,000. It's like, but that doesn't mean we don't need real politicians. That means that we need humans who have political brains and experience in the community and know where we came from and where we're going. And when you have a 30-year-old that's only been alive for 30 years, you don't know where we're going and you don't know where we came from because you just simply have not been alive long enough.
Yeah, and it just falls into that whole, I would view it as, charisma. And then, yeah, I would just view it as a form of charisma without action. Like, here's this guy who wants to, make up his own policies and everything and just talk about how great it is without showing any answers or sources about how it might work or anything like that. And I know this is not related, but it's kind of familiar or similar, I would say. But have you two heard of the Fyre Festival?
I've heard of it. I never watched the, what was it, a documentary that came out about it?
Scott, have you heard about it?
No.
So this was one of the biggest events. It was supposed to be a music festival where everybody paid tens of thousands of dollars to get a ticket and go to the Bahamas on this one island that supposedly a lot of famous people went to. And it was created by a guy named Billy McFarland, and he promoted it nonstop. He used charisma. He even used a bit of persuasion just to get it off. And he even got social media influencers to promote his work. And it was just going to be this giant weekend of luxurious hotels, very expensive foods, lots of music events going on. But then as soon as everybody showed up, there was hardly anything. There was like tents, there was like boxed sandwiches and prepackaged foods and everything. And this guy Billy McFarland pleaded guilty on wire fraud,
Wow.
and he defrauded multiple investors, and now he's currently in jail right now.
Right, and that's like, okay, so yeah, charm, charisma, fake it till you make it. Like that's one half of it, but like also you shouldn't be faking it if there's nothing that you have that validates your ability to make
Yeah,
it.
it's just like any cult leader, right? Like Osho or that Bikram guy who like stole his teacher's yoga practice and then came to the States and was like, "Hey, guess what? I invented this new yoga practice." Now everybody in, Western culture knows hot yoga is Bikram yoga. Just 'cause he was a super charismatic guy.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, I don't know. We were watching Enola Holmes the other day, and it takes place like at the time that women are fighting to get the vote, and at a time when the lords of like the ancestral keepers of the land are the guys that make all the decisions. Like, there's a lord's vote, and they vote, and it passes, and women get the right to vote. And it's like people talk about the patriarchy as this group of men, all men that are suppressing women. And it's like, if you go back just a short minute, it's like, actually, no, it's royal blood and royal families and ancestral inheritance and lineage. And it's this structure of brainwashing the descendants to maintain and uphold the values that came before them. And it's like, it's not because they're men, it's not because they're not women, it's because of their families and the system that was in place. And it's
Yeah,
like,
being a man didn't help much if you were a serf.
exactly. Like, and it's like preservationalism or whatever you want to call it. And it's like, Mycroft Holmes makes this one comment. He's like, yeah, that's what we need, more uninformed voters. And it's like, no, you're right. Like, that is a cynical statement to make because we don't need more uninformed vo voters. Like, if you want to get involved in politics, here's an idea. Inform yourself of what political party you represent and get to a place where you can respect and engage with the opposing faction because we are humans and you need to be aware of the fact that the only good politician is a politician who is actually a human, who's lived a human's life and has human experience and perspective and can share that in an open debate with multiple humans who are all trying to work for the betterment of all mankind.
Yeah, that's a good argument to go down though. Like Mycroft makes the same argument that, Plato might have made. You know, democracy doesn't work. If you're going to vote, you have to have, you know, actual knowledge. Like, the protest against not giving women the vote wasn't like, no, women can't vote. There's a problem with women. It's, no, there's a problem with too many people having their hands in the cookie jar.
Yeah.
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 I mean, it's kind of worked out for us so far, but that depends on how well you see the outcome of Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau.
Well, and it's interesting because you can look at that through a bunch of lenses, but like 150 years ago, these people were putting their children through a form of residential school system to indoctrinate and brainwash and conform them to the reality they wanted them to live. They taught women how to be courteous and charming, and they taught men how to be decisive and bold. And they brought their belief systems over to North America and tried to do the same thing. They didn't invent some weird, perverse form of torture. And in fact, Lord of the Flies will show you very well and in no uncertain terms that this is the abuse that children put upon themselves in the environments they were in, not because of their skin color or their race or their ethnicity or anything other than the fact that the system was attempting to preserve the system.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to look, you have to be able to look at that with a sober eye and realize, like, okay, so humans that aren't sociopathic or schizophrenic start with a good intention. And then they resist change. And then they get fear. And then they have beliefs that tell them how the world works. And then it comes out and you get residential school systems, apartheid, genocide, communism, socialism. And we're all trying to figure it out. But in today's society, we have the least amount of cultural ritual, ceremonial preparedness for life as humans. We don't get indoctrinated into anything beyond our family home. And our family home has been living the same recursive lack of meaning. And we're now hopelessly addicted to narcotics, rejecting all religion, and walking blindly through life with belief systems we don't have the iron to actually look at.
Yeah, you're making me think a lot about Joseph Campbell and his functions of mythology, because he talks about the exact same thing of what you're talking about. We do have a way of, you know, getting everybody together on the same page, and it's called mythology and religion. You know, if you say, we tell all the children that if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you'll get killed and eaten, you know, everyone's gonna do what they're supposed to do. They're all gonna work in tandem with one another. But like, that kind of system doesn't work in what we've done with Western society and all this freedom that everybody has now. We can't just go back on that. The monkey's out of the bottle. Everyone's already free. We can't just tell them, no, you gotta do it all this way now. Those ways don't work. And they said, well, it works for me. So I don't know what you're complaining about.
It's like cults, religions, and dictatorships all share one primary theme, and that's that they have the answers to every single contextual issue life will present you. They have the way that you are going to live your life. And the reason it doesn't work is because of contradictions, right? Like, that's why the West and the powerhouses of the world rose up to beat Hitler in the Second World War. That's why, you know, crazy weird cults in the 60s and 70s had to kill themselves, because they couldn't actually fit into society. And that's why dictatorships do so well, because when you have all the answers and you can get rid of the doubt of your infantry, when you're all flying under the same banner and united towards your causes, you can get very far and feel very meaningful. And I think that both sides of the military in any world war, or any war of that matter, felt very meaningful. But that's step one. And step two is, what happens when the soldiers get home, and how are they respected, and how meaningful do they feel? And I know we won the war, but I'll tell you right now, the soldiers on the enemy side that were operating from the base of, we're going to change the world and this is how everyone's going to live, if they had have won, their government would have taken better care of them than our governments have, because we weren't creating a way to live. We were reacting to a way that we all know we should not live. And it's like, good, thank God we did that. But damn it, we need to assess what we're doing.
Yeah, and you have to think about how everyone is going to have a different perspective of that war that soldier just fought. Not only just, you know, on the other side of the world, they have a different perspective, but, you know, every individual in the country that soldier's returning to is going to have a different opinion. You don't know if you're going to, you know, start up a conversation with someone waiting in line at Starbucks and they'll just say, oh, thank you for your service, sir. We're lucky to have you. Or they'll call you some kind of dog of the military and just spit on your shoes. Like, it's a coin toss. It's anything could happen in this world.
But it's like, that's like, no matter what, the soldiers, even now coming home, they do not have the safety net of meaning and fulfillment after the war stops to continue to live an actualized life and feel good and have a system to help them deal with PTSD or anything, right? And it's like, I don't have the answers, and I am the first to have a very strong and uninformed opinion of something, and I'm afraid people take what I say more seriously than I do myself. But like, I know that I'm a 26-year-old, and that in 2 decades I will have a hell of a lot more experience, and if I don't have these conversations now, I'll have the same opinions in 20 years.
Right.
Yeah, I'm gonna be one of
having these conversations.
Yeah, I'm also gonna be one of these 20-something-year-olds who wants to get into this. So I would say, when soldiers come back, they should be evaluated for their health, their mental health, immediately. They can't just come back home and be like, okay, what do I do now? And when they come back, they're gonna be confused with so many changes since they've been gone for so long, and you know, they're not going to have the qualities that they once had before they went overseas and fought a war. And I've drove through Houston, I've noticed many homeless veterans holding up signs, asking for food, asking for money and everything like that. So that's one thing that can be done, is just reevaluate a soldier coming back from overseas and give them the proper treatments they need so that they can go back to their old selves if possible, really.
Yeah, and help them get settled in like a new home, get them a new job. You know, we have all these kinds of like programs for lots of people that just fell through the cracks, but the least we could do is, you know, provide the same kind of help to our troops and veterans.
And well, to go back to what you were saying, Will, around this whole idea of contradictions and everything and all these philosophies, I think the best thing that we can do, and it may not be, well, this might sound like a contradiction, but you have to pick which seeds you want to plant in your life when you grow. And remember to maintain balance. Remember yin and yang, just have that completely in the center.
Yeah.
And just figure out where those seeds grow into.
The easiest thing to do is nothing, and the hardest thing to do is think about it. And it sucks because, you know, our systems have cracks that are built into them. Like, I've got buddies in the military right now, and they're telling me, you know, like, especially in the middle of a pandemic, when people have the biggest problems, they're waiting months and years to hear back from Veterans Affairs and from doctors and from lawyers and from bosses and from supervisors and from like every single place that something can go wrong. We've got like a wait period. And it's like, if we have fundamental issues across the board, we need a paradigm shift. And it's like, yeah, sure, anybody can say that. And obviously that's a huge daunting thing. But the problem is that most people, your average person, has no idea that stuff's being done about this. Like, I don't even know what I don't know is being done about this, but I know that I don't know what is being done about this. Whereas your run-of-the-mill Facebook user, like, I had this problem last week, and it's the reason I deleted the app off my phone. Someone commented on Facebook, what's being done about the homeless population? This is disgusting. This is gross. Really rude, shaming these homeless people. And I was like, well, actually, you know, in about 5 minutes, I can tell you exactly what's being done about it, because I went to council and I talked to council members, and I'm aware of the committees that are built around this. And it's like, I post all these answers to this question, and then by the time I'm done answering it, I realize, oh, they didn't want an answer. Because they're a Facebook user,
they're just
and they wanted to complain. And it's like, what do you do when you're dealing with people?
Yes.
The best you can? I don't know. I'm sure that I could keep talking for another hour, but boys, we're going to run circles.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to, you know, how we're doing and everything right now. I mean, Will, you've mentioned before recorded is you're going through how many weeks of training right now for your
26 week business coaching program. I'm on week 3 as of Wednesday.
Week 3. Okay. So what are you getting away from that so far?
So far I'm early stage, and I've got my accountability partner that I'm actually meeting up with this afternoon, which I need to get off in the next little bit and get ready for that. So an accountability partner in business is an incredible thing. And then I've got a workbook, two or three workbooks, and an additional mindful entrepreneur mindfulness course that I'm doing. So what we're doing in the first few weeks is identifying our perfect target person and then our perfect solution. And then we're going to do everything in between so that we can actually know where our market is and start selling them the thing they need. And for me, like, that's the meat and potatoes. And this past year of pandemic, I've reevaluated my position on a brick and mortar office, and I'm going to start marketing to the world and doing Zoom coaching after this and during this business coaching progress or process. So it's interesting because it's got hypnosis involved, and it's got business strategy involved, and it's got homework involved. And it's, you know, one of those things where you hate homework all through your schooling life, and then you become an adult and it's like, oh good, I've got homework. I have a thing that I can do that will help me do the thing I want to do.
Yeah.
So I'll have a better answer in 3 weeks, but right now I'm working on identifying my perfect target market.
Right on.
That's good. Scott, what are you working on?
Well, I've been starting these a bunch of books on storytelling and writing in the medium of comics, so that's been fun. Been doing this free drawing course on like YouTube. I found this little playlist and thing called Drawbox. I've been doing that, so just working on the fundamentals of art and just fully committing to making these comic books I have all these ideas for. Got like 4 full up Google documents and a bunch of reference material and stuff, so that's been pretty fun.
Awesome.
That sounds really cool.
And just reading a bunch of comics for like inspiration and like studying how they do things. Like, I'm a big fan of Alan Moore, so like every time I go back through an old graphic novel, it's like, oh, I like what he did there. I've also been trying to learn color theory, the basics of that too. So going back and reading my favorite comics and like seeing all the color choices, it's like, oh wow, I didn't realize before that the Killing Joke was all in Joker colors. Like every dominant color was orange, purple, or green. Like, oh, that's pretty neat little choice they made there. So just learning more and more about the ins and outs of creating a graphic novel and visual art and visual storytelling, it's been pretty eye-opening.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Right on. What about yourself, Pat?
I've been learning different techniques in copywriting and marketing, and just trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. There's a lot of writing and rewriting involved. I do plan on doing some freelancing pretty soon. throughout October, and I'm currently working on the fourth draft of my novel. And I've also heard that Sober October is coming up. Any thoughts on that?
Yep. Yeah, I think I might do the Sober October. Certainly alcohol, perhaps even the marijuana. Important to do a detox. A month of detox is a good time.
What do you think about journaling for 30 days?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm going to do 3 weeks of journaling before I make my first blog post, and then I'm going to start doing blog posts consistently on my website and actually start fleshing that out. Because, and same with Facebook posts. Like, I feel like if you want to post on the internet, you should do 3 weeks of journaling first.
Yeah, get your thoughts out first.
Yeah, because I don't want to have a diary for a website or a Facebook page, but I do feel I deserve to make statements on the internet, and I don't think I'm ready to yet. But before the end of October, I want to have some blog posts and then not stop for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I just don't think I have the courage for that. Like, Facebook seems like the worst place to make any kind of statement.
Yeah, no, I probably will never make a Facebook post. Don't get me wrong. I hate Facebook. It's the scum of the earth, and it causes cancer.
Well, that's, I mean, you can use Facebook. Well, you can use Facebook for your business.
I could, but that would involve me being on Facebook, and it's the scum of the earth, and it causes cancer, and I just can't do it. I will use Google AdWords and have a website. If people need me, they're probably on Facebook, and Google Ads are on Facebook, so that's close enough to Facebook for me.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Like, if I was building a product like dressers, I would have an Instagram account for that. I still wouldn't have a Facebook account. Like, I can't do it. It is so disgusting, and the algorithm is just designed to make you hate your friends. I it's just awful. I have a Facebook account. I made it a week and a half ago because I'm in a group for discussion around my yoga teacher training. It's a private group, and then a group for my business coaching. Again, a private group. I like it. I love it. The dopamine hits are real. And like I said, I made a post on someone's post that was my friend on Facebook. And I was like, oh, right, that's not how Facebook works. And so now I check my Facebook when I'm on my computer. And even then, it's seldom because it's garbage. It's absolute garbage.
Yeah. I wonder, like, sometimes I wonder if there's like a format of Facebook that could actually work to unite people instead of divide people and open it up for intelligent conversation. But I think the closest we have is YouTube and Discord in smaller amounts of people.
Yeah, I think micro communities are the answer. When you create a space for all people to exist in, what happens is you get disgusting garbage.
Yeah, but that makes me think of, you know, John Galt running away to start Atlantis. And, you know.
Yeah, and I don't think that's enough either.
Yeah. It's like
that's his own version of a cave.
Right.
Like, isolation isn't the answer. Absolutely not. We need the ability for micro groups to be able to communicate with other micro groups. And we need to be aware that there is a community at large. But we do not need to post pretty photos of our fucking toenails on Facebook.
Yeah, it's got to work in stages. We have to, you know, sort ourselves out as individuals first. And then individuals in a cohesive group. And then cohesive groups that can interact with other cohesive groups and create groups of cohesive groups.
Well, and that's just it. But the problem with the whole tribing out to the things that you like, for example, people that work out all the time. If that's your entire life, you don't have a life.
Yeah.
Like, if your hobby is your life, it's not your hobby. It can't be two things. That's a contradiction. So micro groups are also just as dangerous, because if you think that you're going to get everything you need out of a group of people that agree with you all of the time, guess what? Yeah. You're wrong.
So when we go back a step, when we're narrowing it down to the individual has to be a part of several different cohesive groups that are all able to interact with each other in a cohesive group of cohesive groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually those groups work out to countries and then to continents and then world governments, and you know, whatever else the future has in store for us.
But yeah, Facebook, aka Baron's General Chat. I don't know if you've ever played World of Warcraft, but it's the same thing. Baron's Chat and Facebook, it's just this awful cesspool of people yelling things to get attention.
Yeah, with any like global chat in a video game, it's like, okay, these people are just angry. Why are you so angry? I came onto RuneScape to, you know, mine for an hour and take my mind off something, and these people are just arguing about Donald Trump nonstop. I have to mute my chat.
Yeah, it's like, this will be the note that I end on, because I need to go, guys.
Okay. Yeah.
What I said to my brother-in-law yesterday, like, if you're coming home with a whole bunch of business-related stuff on your mind, and you know the people that live with you don't give a shit about everything that you have to say. Yeah. Like, it's not a comment on you. It's not a comment on the value of what you have to say. It's not a comment on your business. It's just simply the wrong shaped hole for the peg you have. What you need is someone who wants to talk about your business, so that when you get home, you can talk about whatever actually is worth talking about with your family members. You can see the opportunity instead of trying to talk and having the conversation fall flat and then feeling undervalued and disrespected and then being angry and then trying to convey that this is how you feel and that you would have felt differently if they had reacted differently. Like, no, that's a gravity problem. That's the gravity of the situation. You need to see the opportunity that your family member's having a bad day and you need to make them some cupcakes. And then they can get to your level and then you can do something creative. But it's like, you can't bring the wrong energy to the wrong place and expect the right result. That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge. That's a pretty good place to end, too.
Yeah.
So, like I said at the beginning, you can check us out at our website, bookwave.club. See all of our nice blogs. Keep up with what books we're reading, which are Uncle Tom's Cabin right now, and the Bible, first book of Samuel. And until next time, may the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.